You talked a little bit at your chamber speech about your goals of the Fed goals of controlling inflation and unemployment. Which of those presents the greatest ongoing threat to the stability of the economy? Is there one that has priority over the other?
That's a good question, Rob. So, I think that, you know, it's always a constant balancing act between the two and trying to, in general, I would say that a lot of the shocks that we face, it's important not to overestimate the tension between the mandates of maximum employment and price stability. So when I talk about a mandate, what I'm referring to is the fact that Congress is statutorily mandated the Federal Reserve to promote price stability and to promote maximum employment. So I think that many shocks that the economy faces actually sort of move us in the same direction. So what I mean by that is if we have an adverse shock that typically pushes downward on prices, and it will push upward on unemployment. And the response to that from the Monetary Policy Authority would be the same, which is to provide more accommodation. In normal times, it would mean cut interest rates. If things are getting too hot, to use the vernacular, you're going to see upward movements in inflation, downward movements in unemployment, and the appropriate action there would be then to reduce accommodation. So many shocks actually take the form of doing things in the same direction, end up having the same kind of response from mandating the same kind of response from the central bank. A good example of that happened this past year, actually, because inflation came down. Excuse me, got backwards. Inflation rose over the past year from the end of 2010. Inflation was very low. 2011, it's returned to being closer. In fact, over the past 9 months, core inflation has been around 2%, which is in our what we view as being consistent with our mandate for price stability. And unemployment has fallen. So both of those sort of move in the same direction of what telling you about what you should do with monetary policy.
You also talked about being an advocate of creating a public contingency plan. Is that something that the Federal Reserve Bank is close to doing, or the Federal Reserve is close to doing, or is that just an idea that's being discussed?
I think a number of my colleagues, including myself, have spoken for the need of more clarity in the formation of policy. I think that need for clarity can be met in a number of ways. I think a contingency plan is one way to do it, but I don't think it's the only way by any means. So I put that idea out there as a way to think to try to formalize the need for more clarity in future monetary policy making. But it's, you know, there's a number of my colleagues have presented other kinds of ideas, and I'm open to considering those ideas. I think just that we have to provide more guidance about what we're going to be doing in the future in response to the evolution of conditions than we've done so far.
You know, even if we can take a step back here a little bit for viewers who may not be very familiar with monetary policy and what it is that you do, why is it that it's the unemployment and the price stability that you guys really do look at? And then in turn, how do you control that in just a brief synopsis?
Sure, that's a good question. So the the Federal Reserve's dual mandate comes from congressional statute, and that says, as I indicated, is to promote price stability and to promote maximum employment. So essentially what you're trying to do is to use the levers of monetary policy. And in normal times, what those levers really refer to is just you're controlling the using buying and selling assets so as to meet a target for short-term interest rates. We basically intervene by buying and selling reserves in exchange for assets in the Fed funds market. That sets the short-term interest rate in that market. And really when investors are thinking about, they're really thinking about the path of short-term interest rates. is if short-term interest rates are very high, then they think, I'll buy those assets in the marketplace, as opposed to making loans or as opposed to spending. And by lowering those returns, we can, in turn, have people think to themselves, well, instead of buying those assets, I think I'll spend, I'll buy some goods, or I'll invest. When people spend more, that's generally viewed as putting upward pressure on prices and putting downward pressure on unemployment. When people spend less, that's generally viewed as putting downward pressure on prices and putting upward pressure on employment. And the goal in particular is to try to offset the variation in inflationary pressures. When you think about the price stability mandate, the goal is to offset inflationary pressures in such a way as to keep inflation in that 2% or a bit less range. I don't know if that was helpful.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks. Can you just give an overview for people who are not familiar with the Minneapolis Fed specifically, in terms of geographically, what territory do you cover? And then from there, maybe just an assessment currently of the state of the Sioux Falls economy as it compares to the rest of the region.
Okay, so let me start with the sort of structure of the Federal Reserve System. So the system, the Federal Reserve System, is an unusually decentralized central bank. So you look around the world, the U.S. has a very unique structure to its central bank. And we have the Board of Governors in Washington. Usually it's supposed to have 7 people on it. Right now it has 5. It has two vacancies. And the members of the Board of Governors are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. Then there are 12 regional reserve banks and the presidents of those reserve banks also serve, take part in the monetary policy deliberations, and on a rotating basis also vote on monetary policy actions by the Federal Open Markets Committee. Minneapolis, there are 12 regional reserve banks. Minneapolis is number 9 out of the 12 regional feds. If you look at a dollar bill, you can see what district the bill comes out of, and it will have a number on it and a letter correspondingly. And ours would be 9 and I. And our district is huge. I mean, our district is from Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the upper peninsula of Michigan. Just in terms of geographically, this is the second biggest district of the 12. Population-wise, it's the smallest. So that low density. So why do we have this decentralized system? It's because there's the vision of the Federal Reserve Act. The vision of the Federal Reserve System is it's useful to have a two-way communication between the citizens of this country and the making of monetary policy. And the presidents, like myself, are the conduit for that conversation to take place. I come out to places like Sioux Falls, talk to people about how they perceive the local economy is going, and I also tell them, as I did today in my speech, I was talking to the South Dakota Chamber, so it's actually a broader cross-section than just in Sioux Falls. But you're basically trying to communicate about what were the actions the Fed took? Why did it do it? What were we hoping to accomplish? How have we done? I think it's very important for that dialogue to take place, not just from people in Washington, but from the representatives of the local economies in the making of monetary policy. I think the Sioux Falls economy, I'm going to say, I bet you can find a lot of people who can talk more expertly about the Sioux Falls economy than me. But the bottom line, I think, is I'll talk about what I know a little bit more about, which is the South Dakota economy. And I think the bottom line for South Dakota is the recession has not been as hard on South Dakota at all. I mean, unemployment remains gratifyingly low in South Dakota. It's below 5%, whereas the country as a whole is at 9. This is a keeping with actually what's true in our district, that unemployment is gratifyingly low, below 7% for the area I talked about. I will say, though, that the growth in employment in South Dakota over the past year has been relatively slow. It's sort of mirrored what we've seen with the national economy, this slow growth in employment. And it's not as much of a concern in South Dakota because your unemployment rate's under 5%. But you see some of the same forces, I would say, at work in South Dakota that you see at the national economy, which is not surprising given that South Dakota is not an island unto itself. It interacts, of course, with both the national economy and the global economy.
Are there states within the region that stand out for one reason or another in terms of good economy, bad economy? Are they all pretty much?
Well, I think if you look north, you'll see an exception, and that's North Dakota. And it's being driven by commodities, namely oil. The oil boom in North Dakota is creating a situation which you will not hear any, I don't think, I don't want to say anywhere else in the United States, but you don't hear often in the United States context, which is labor shortage. And it's because of the new technologies being developed in hydrofracking and it being applied in the extraction of oil in the Bakken region. Seems to have made it's had an enormous impact on the North Dakota economy. Unemployment is very low, sub 4%, and enormous numbers of jobs are available. They're looking for people to come to work there. So that area is what stands out. I would say Minnesota is the bulk of our population of our district lives in. So about 5 million people in Minnesota. There's about 9 million in the district. And Minnesota has tracked the national economy, but not to the same extent. So our unemployment rate in Minnesota peaked at around 8.4%. The national economy got up to 10. We've come down. Now I think we're back below 7 in Minnesota. But our rate of progress, just like the national economy, rate of progress back to where we want to be, like 5, has been very slow. So I think if you told a district-wide story, with the exception of North Dakota, you told a district-wide story of the recession hasn't had as big an impact, but the recovery from whatever impact there has been slow, I think that would be the right story for the district. North Dakota just stands out as being totally different.
In your conversations with people as you travel around the district, how much of this lack of job growth do you think is due to psychological reluctance to add jobs versus actual economic limitations to adding jobs?
I think it's a difficult question to sort out. We struggle with it on an ongoing basis. I think that in the because part of the psychological aspect is that people feel uncertain or unsure about actual economic conditions as well. So it all feeds into itself in a challenging way. I will say at the national level, less so at the district level, but at the national level, when you look at surveys, confidence seems in very low levels. And the level of confidence seems disconnected from actual economic conditions to me. The economy seems stronger to me than what is warranted by the survey evidence. In the district level, when I talk to people, you have a feeling people are cautious, but they're less cautious than they were a year ago and even less cautious than they were 2 years ago, just like you see but sorting out whether it's their caution that's causing the slow economy or the slow economy is causing their caution is very challenging. I am more of a fundamentals guy always. I tend to put more weight on the fundamentals, but I have to say that the disconnect at the national level between the survey numbers and the economy as a whole is puzzling to me.
I don't know how much you can speak in detail about a particular industry, but have the challenges in the financial services industry in particular, have they played out? Are they still have a ways to go to work out, particularly like in credit cards?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the big drag is on the recovery is less on the from financial services. And I'll talk about two aspects of your question. So one is just in terms of employment growth and where the drags in employment growth are coming from. And, you know, I think there you saw actually a lot of different sectors were hit at the same time, but different levels of impact. Manufacturing was really hit hard, has come back very strong, but because it was coming back from such a low base, it's still down from where we were. There's another way to take your question, though, which is about on the balance sheet of households and what their financial position looks like. And there, I think progress has been slow. Consumers got hit very hard by the decline in housing equity and in stock equities. And, you know, if you're thinking about saving through your house or through your stocks for your kids going off to college, you're going to have to make that up somehow. And the way you're going to do it is by cutting back on spending. And that's a drag on the economy for sure.
If you could talk a little bit to interest rates, I believe you said during your speech that kind of during the recession, or at what specific point was it, that they were lowered from 5.2% down to ranging between 0 and 0.25. How were you able to drop them so much? Kind of talk about what went into that and how they've stayed so low.
So here I'm talking as an outside observer, I'll say, because I was not a part of the this was all took place before I became president. I became president in October 2009. But it's I described the situation August of 2007. The Fed had interest rates at above 5%. And it was about in August of 2007 that is usually did as the beginning of the financial crisis that I talked about at some length in my speech, where people became, there was a growing sense of uncertainty and panic and began to fill the financial markets. And it wasn't something that happened overnight. It was something that slowly built over time and reached a crescendo, I would say, in the latter stages of 2008. The Fed has the ability to target short-term interest rates. Really, you're targeting very short-term interest rates, really about a daily interest rate. And they basically have the ability to control that short-term interest rate. They can't drive it below zero, but they can get it down. And they took it down from 5% down to 0.25 point and 0.25 percentage point. But that's a relatively, we're talking over from August 2007 through the December 2008 is when we got down to close to zero. So that's actually, you know, there's a lot of meetings in there, probably something like 10 or 12 meetings. I'm not going to remember exactly the rate of progression.
But, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Just wanted to make sure that I was understanding one observation correctly. Did, in terms of the health of the overall regional economy, am I right to understand that you think it's better than the perception is, or at least the perception that people are reporting?
No, in the regional economy, I don't get a sense of the same disconnect. So when I talk to the people in the economy, and I talk to how that level of confidence they feel, I feel it's appropriate given where we are in the recovery. Whereas at the national level, when you look at the surveys of consumer confidence, business confidence, it seems very low considering what I consider to be the underlying strength of the economy. And I think a number of forecasters would say the same.
How does your role change, I mean, as we progress, as we sort of climb out of this recession, and how is your role different in recessionary times?
My role as...
What the Federal Reserve does, I mean, how you guys act and your decision-making process.
So we have an enormous amount of what we call accommodation in place. We've bought over $2 trillion of longer-term government assets. That's matched on our balance sheet by banks holding a lot of deposits, what we call bank reserves, but are essentially banks holding deposits with the Fed. At the same time, we've kept interest rates very low. There will be a point in time where things have evolved sufficiently where we have to begin undoing this enormous package of accommodation. If we don't do that, we're going to have high inflation. We will not be meeting our target on inflation, and we risk, the real risk there is not whether we get to 2.5 or 3, but it more that what helps policy, monetary policy work and keeps inflation and unemployment where we want them to be is the idea that inflation expectations stay where we think they should be and where that we're all on the same page. The public and the Fed are on the same page of where inflation is going to be. If the public starts to think, boy, the Fed isn't really credible about keeping inflation low, then inflation expectations can start to go upwards. This happened in the 70s, and what the Fed had to do at that point is tighten policy very sharply. and raised rates very dramatically, and that led to a big increase in unemployment. So really our tension is really about a short-term unemployment thing versus a long-term unemployment, that you give a little, have short-term unemployment go up a little bit now because you're trying to make sure that inflation stays under control. By doing that, you make sure you don't have to do the kind of tightening we had to do in the late 70s, early 80s.
Can you just give a basic overview for people of the concept of quantitative easing and speak at all to the likelihood of a third round of it?
So what quantitative easing refers to, first of all, I'll talk about the mechanics and I'll talk about the term. So the mechanics are simply that the Fed buys longer term government securities. And the way they're doing that is by, you have to finance it somehow. And the way the Fed does that is by selling reserves essentially to the banks. And that allows them to go out and buy longer term government securities. Why is the Fed doing that? The Fed is doing that by longer term assets, longer term bonds have risk associated with them. It's not the risk of default. It's not the risk. We're buying stuff that's backed by the government or issued by the government. So there's no risk of default on these things. It's more the interest rates vary over time. Because interest rates vary over time, the prices of these bonds can vary over time. By taking out these longer term bonds out of the economy, the Fed is taking longer term, that interest rate risk out of the economy. It means the private sector no longer has to hold it, and they're more willing to lend money to longer term projects because they're more willing to take on that kind of longer term risk. We don't like the term quantitative easing in the Fed, and I'll explain why. It's because we think that actually focuses on the wrong feature of the program. Quantitative easing makes it sound it's about the expansion of our balance sheet. We think it's really all about the composition of our balance sheet. We're making it more long term. It's not so. In September, the Fed actually sold off some short-term government securities and bought longer-term ones. We view that as basically being totally consistent with the program. It's often called quantitative easing. Will there be a further purchases of this kind that I've described? It will depend on the evolution of economic conditions. Certainly, if it's a tool that remains available to the Federal Reserve and the FOMC if needed.
Is there a numerical goal for unemployment similar, as I understand it, the goal is to maybe keep inflation at 2% or under? Is there a goal for unemployment?
So the level of inflation we're aiming at is 2% or a bit under. This is sort of a medium-term objective. You know, it's not something we're trying to hit on a daily basis or anything like that, but. You know, I pointed the data over a four-year period, and I think that's the right 3 to 4 year horizon is the right horizon to look at. Unemployment is much more challenging. I think that what is the level of unemployment that's consistent with our mandate is more challenging to sort out because there's a bunch of economic conditions that can change and move that around. So I would say that it's very hard at a given point in time to identify what that number would be. With that said, I think whatever it is, I think 9 is above it. So whatever that number is, 9 is too high. I think I'll speak for myself, but the committee's also stated that in its statements that it issues after every meeting. It stated that unemployment at 9% is too high. And I agree with that.
I don't know if you're able to speak to it, but are you able to give any other forecasts or anything, what you can expect for the future or what we can expect with kind of what you guys, the inflation, the interest rates, anything like that?
So I can speak for myself. The Federal Open Markets Committee at the end of its meetings in January, April, June, and November, also issues what's called a summary of economic projections. So all 17 meeting participants will submit forecasts for core inflation, unemployment, and real GDP growth. And but you won't see all 17 listed, but you'll see very summary statistics listed. So you just go to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors website, and you can just see it all there. So we talk constantly. No one listens. But in terms of my own forecast, I'm expecting real GDP growth in over the next 2 years, 2012 and 2013, to average between 2.5% and 3%, about what's average for the U.S. The problem is that that would, you know, if we went back to 2005, you would say that's, you know, it's a good year. But the problem is we have unemployment rate of 9%. That's going to really, you need much faster growth than that to make significant headway on unemployment. So the I'm forecasting the unemployment rate to be around 8% by the end of 2013, which is, you know, I mean, very, it means progress. And I want to underscore that, but it's slow progress. Inflation, I would say my forecast for inflation is higher than what you would see in the summary of economic projections from my colleagues. I'm forecasting inflation to be slightly above 2%, you know, maybe 2.2 or so, both core and headline over the next 2 years.